Hey everyone, this is James Mackey and welcome to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. Join us as we cover high-level thought leadership and step-by-step guides on how to make people a competitive advantage for your organization. I'm incredibly proud to be the CEO of Secure Vision, the sponsor of this show and the number one contract recruiting, embedded recruiting, and RPO firm. A thank you to our partners, Greenhouse, the hiring operating system for people-first companies, and GEM, the all-in-one hiring solution recruiters love. Let's go. Hello, welcome to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. I'm your host, James Mackey. Very excited for hosting our guest today. We're joined by David Murray and Josh Merrill. Welcome to the show, guys.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And before we dive into our topics, David, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So my background is computer science and human-computer interaction. I was an early PM Gmail back in like 2006, 2008 period. Then I've done product and engineering roles at startups of different stages and sizes, both on the consumer side, like gaming, as well as on the enterprise side. Most recently, I was CTO at doctor.com. We were selling marketing software to healthcare practitioners and now focused on the product and development side at Confirm.
Nice. Josh, how about you?
Yeah. So my name's Josh. Co-founder of Confirm with Dave. Dave and I met actually 20 years ago in undergrad. So it was actually kind of a huge thrill to be able to start a company, actually kind of our second company together. But prior to Confirm, I spent 6 years at a company called Carta. I was the chief product officer there. And like Dave at doctor.com, we experienced all the pain of performance management, both as people managers and people leaders, and also as people who wanted to improve our own performance and just saw how incredibly broken the system was and decided to do something about it.
Love it. Love it. And that's why I'm so excited for today is to really get into performance reviews, understand what's broken. There's issues with feedback cycle. There's issues with bias. There's a lot of problems when it comes to doing performance reviews properly. And maybe we need to really step back and totally rethink what we're doing. And so I would love to just dive into at a high level, what problem are you solving and how are you going about doing it? So I don't know who wants to take that first, but that would be great to just do kind of like the high level overview there.
Josh, I'll let you do the high level overview, but just to plant a brief seed in terms of like some interesting stats and stuff, you know, we oftentimes have performance reviews with manager ratings. I'll just mention, there's a lot of research on this. About 60% of the manager's rating as a rater is based off of their own idiosyncrasies as a rater. Like, are they easy rater or hard rater? And then 20% is error. And then the remaining 20% is the person's actual performance. So just setting the stage, we're dealing with a pretty broken process. But I'll let you take it away, Josh.
So I'll admit that's like way worse than I thought. I mean, I would assume that it's pretty inefficient, but like that is total trash. Yeah. That's not helpful at all.
Right? It's a totally broken, you know, building on some of those stats, over 60% of employees believe that performance reviews are a partial or total waste of time. So it's a system that's working for nobody. I think it's important to understand why. And to understand that, you kind of have to look at where they came from. So performance reviews they're 100 years old, right? They came out of the U.S. military after World War I, and they were a way for the commanding officer to rate the subordinate officer on a 5-point scale. That was the innovation 100 years ago. And work was hierarchical. And so we brought that methodology into the workplace. And that is the manager review that we still use today. So work got more complex as the decades went on. So you had kind of the rise of the 360 in the 80s and 90s. But the problem with all of those old methodologies is they fundamentally don't match the way that we work today. The way that we work today is in networks. And what that means is you can hop onto Slack or you can hop onto Microsoft Teams. You can direct message anybody in the company, right? The CEO, the intern, everybody in between, they have direct access to you. Work is collaborative and cross-functional. Almost nothing of real significance gets done anymore without a team of people. And by the way, that team could be all over the world because we have Zoom and we have Google Meet and WebEx. So the point is that while we work in networks, the way that we evaluate that work is based on a pre-digital conception of getting things done, and it doesn't work anymore. That's where a lot of the problems come into performance reviews. A lot of the problems around, you know, managing up, often to the exclusion of helping others. Manager visibility is lower than it's ever been. So we see a lot of those problems come into performance reviews.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of issues here. So I would love to just get a sense on what is the solution that you guys like recommend, right? Like, you know, based on all the problems, like how are you going about solving it?
Well, one thing we can say is what we don't recommend just okay. to start, right? So manager reviews definitely have their utility, but the problem is managers can shield the folks below them, right? Somebody who's really good at managing up and has sharp elbows, they can get away with it pretty well. And some folks do peer 360s to try and get an additional view beyond the manager's perspective. But the problem is in most organizations, 360s are cherry picked, right? People pick the people that are going to say the right things about them, the good things about them. And you know who's not benefiting from 360s are your amazing employees, because those are the people that are getting asked by like 20 people to fill out these peer reviews because everybody wants a review from so-and-so. And so because there's this like cherry picking selection bias, you're already starting with muddied waters. And you have to end up filling out these massive pieces of information, which maybe feel good to the recipient. But when it comes to like, let's just say a CEO or executives or management teams that are trying to make hard decisions about their talent, you know, we've seen a lot of organizations have to go through rifts in the not too distant past. Like when you're making those decisions, it's really hard when all you have is this random 1 to 4 rating and then a bunch of words from people who are just saying all of these good things because they were selected ahead of time. So you probably want to do something other than the current status quo.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I like just thinking at my own company, we do not have like traditional performance reviews. It's more of a ongoing conversation on a weekly basis. I mean, we have very clear performance metrics in place defined for our roles. And it's really just about tracking to that. And every week it's like, okay, are we on track? Or if there is any type of performance concern, it's basically brought to surface immediately. And I think like that, like one of the things that companies miss too, it's like, if there are performance concerns that are not surfaced quickly, they could do a lot of damage. So the idea of like doing an annual performance review, if you do wait a year before you have any kind of like data or insight on something happening with performance, like what is the damage that's being done within that year? And so like, just think about it. And like, particularly if it's something, I mean, everything, you shouldn't have roles in the company that don't impact the customer and revenue. Like to me, it's like, if you cannot show a causal relationship between the work that somebody's doing and how it's actually impacting the company's North Star metrics, why are you hiring for it? Right. And so from there, it's like, if somebody's important enough to hire, like if they're not doing their job well, or something is not aligned for an entire year, like imagine all the damage that can be done. So not only is it an employee, it's beneficial for the employee, it's beneficial for internal promotions, but it's also helping to ensure that things are running smoothly for the organization. So I always see it as like, this is an ongoing conversation versus something that you do at the end of the year or a couple times a year, in my opinion.
Totally. And actually, to make it even worse, in traditional performance cycles that happen once every, you know, year, let's say, where you think of that manager rating as maybe being a 5-point scale, it's not really a 5-point scale, because what usually happens is that the needs improvement, like the one rating, almost never gets used. And the 5 rating is usually really hard to get because a lot of managers don't feel like taking the risk. So what you end up with is this 3-point scale, where a lot of people who really need that critical feedback and needed it months ago are now actually going to get like a meets expectations rating, because that's just the easiest way for a manager to avoid having a difficult conversation and having to bring in HR and things like that. But I think the problem that you're highlighting, James, is in, you know, continuous feedback is great. You know, when I do something as an employee, I want to get feedback, positive or constructive, right away. The challenge becomes when you have to start to make decisions, and especially when you have to make decisions at scale. So imagine that you and I are both managers, And we each have somebody really great on our teams, and they're you know, performing above their level, and we want to see them promoted. And the company comes to us and says, look, we only have one promotion. It's going to be the person on your team, James, or it's going to be the person on my team. How do we decide who's going to get that promotion? And in the world that we live in today, where manager ratings are the end all be all of somebody's performance, what's going to be the deciding factor is your ability to influence other managers and whoever is making that decision around the promotion versus my ability to influence them. What's actually left out of that is the actual employee's performance. That's not an input. What is an input is our ability to advocate and to influence. And, you know, you might say, well, if we were creating, you know, performance management from like a clean sheet of paper, would we want that kind of system, or would we want one that really is about the impacts and the contributions of those individuals and not of their managers?
And to add to that, the interesting other thing that's come out of research is if you look at specifically knowledge workers, right? So I'm not talking about factory workers, but knowledge workers, there's a bunch of research that shows that talent for knowledge workers does not follow a bell curve. Even though ironically, all of these 1-4, 1-3, whatever rating system we use, we have these bell curves. Turns out talent follows a power law, right? The Pareto principle, the 80-20. And this resonates with anybody that works in any large organization, that 80% of the results of any organization comes from 20% of those individuals that are giving outstanding impact. And similarly, 80% of the toxicity, the problematic behavior, the really big problems come from 20% of that set of people that are bringing everybody else down. And so the problem is that when you're doing this manager rating thing, and even this continuous feedback thing, James, like, it's great that you're doing that, right? Like, continuous feedback is important, but it doesn't actually enable you to solve this problem at scale. When you have a company that's even more than 100 employees, you're going to start having trouble figuring out things. And today's world, it's those managers, to Josh's point, it's those managers that know how to sell their employees that are benefiting. So we need a world where we can get some more visibility. And it turns out there's a way to do that through a process called organizational network analysis.
I want to learn more about that because I'm not familiar with it. I mean, like, my whole thought process historically has been like making sure that managers are essentially promoted properly, that they're qualified to measure performance properly, that before they open a role, they should have everything from 30, 60, 90 day plans to showing, again, like a direct causal relationship between the role they're hiring for and the North Star metrics, and measuring performance appropriately through that. And that's kind of how people are promoted, is looking at their impact, the direct impact that they have in accomplishing those goals. And of course, it comes down to the competency of the manager. But I've always seen it as like that type of motion versus like a more sophisticated approach to it. So I would love to learn more about what you mean by that. And just, I mean, that'll just be really helpful. And I'm sure a lot of people tuning in too have like, don't know that, right? So I'm curious to learn more there.
Yeah. So organizational network analysis, or ONA, it's a research methodology. It's been used in academia for a couple of decades now. It's just never really made it into the HR toolkit. But what ONA essentially says is, because we work in networks, we should actually measure the flow of information, communication, the flow of work across those networks. And the way that it would work in practice is if you went to your organization and as part of a performance review, instead of maybe asking a manager, you know, to simply rate an employee on a 1-5 scale, what you would ask every employee is a series of questions. And they're questions about their network. So you might see questions like, who do you go to for help and advice? Or who do you go to when a decision needs to be made? Or who do you believe is making an outstanding contribution? So you're asking everybody in the network about the other connections in their network. And what tends to emerge from that, if you ask everybody in an organization, who do you go to for help and advice? What actually will emerge from that are, who are your subject matter experts? Who are the people actually creating and sharing the knowledge across the organization? If you were to ask a question around, you know, who are you concerned is is creating a problematic workplace, you'll find those problematic employees very quickly because people tend to know who they are. The challenge is, how do you actually capture that information and surface it in a way that managers and leaders can use?
So I love that. And that's actually very clear and easy to understand, which I'm really happy that I was able to kind of grasp it very quickly, and everybody tuning in, I think, will as well. I think it's like, so what you're basically saying is you're collecting feedback from employees on other employees, essentially, to get like a more holistic view on somebody's performance versus just like maybe something coming across as more subjective or just not as potentially accurate coming from one manager. It's like from everybody like on the team, I guess.
Yeah, you're absolutely, you're trying to get more perspectives. Now, to be clear, every perspective is A, subjective, B, biased, right? I mean, we all have implicit biases. But being able to be in a world where instead of one person's subjective biased perspective, which is a manager who may or may not be well-informed, who may or may not have your best interest in mind, who may or may not have a deep amount of personal biases that they may or may not be aware of, to broaden out to a larger group, the group of people that you actually work with, who you directly impact and who impact you. So the idea is, I mean, when it comes to people, there's no perfect solution in terms of like eliminating bias or eliminating, but to be able to enrich the perspective. So it's not just what a manager sees, you see way more. And so particularly like in remote work settings, for example, when you have a manager who maybe isn't even like interacting or able to see what's happening with the folks, you know, below them in the chain of command, turns out you can get a lot of rich information just from hearing, oh, wow, this person is sought to for help and advice on these topics by 12 people, you know, or 25 people. And the crazy thing is that this data, when we do this and we measure this, I mean, this is part of what Confirm does. We've done this with many organizations. And what we find is that power law, that 80-20, the Pareto principle, the thing I mentioned before that all research shows knowledge workers follow instead of a bell curve, we see that in the data. So the people who are most influential in terms of the ones that everybody goes to for help, advice, you know, energy, motivation, that's a power law. And you can see that 20% who are standing out dramatically. And the crazy thing is, and this was really when Josh and I went, oh my gosh, the world is really, really doing this wrong, was when we started looking at that ONA data and correlating it against the manager rating, it was shocking. We saw, just as an example, right? And you don't have to do like comparison, you know, product managers, maybe they have more visibility than like a typical engineer, whatever. Let's just do an apples to apples comparison, right? We had many examples of this, but just to give one, the one that we talk about a lot, we had an L4 software engineer, another L4 software engineer. They both got the same meets expectation manager rating. And they both had been at this company for the same amount of time, a couple of years. One was female, one was male. This female employee, she was recognized by a significant number of people as an outstanding contributor, somebody that was sought out for help and advice by a large number of people and had no concern surfaced from the network. This other person, little to no recognition, little to no sought out for help and advice indicators, and actually a couple concerns about this person. We saw from the comments, they were some concerns about some integrity issues. They got the same manager rating, the same. So they're going to get the same promotion opportunities. They're getting the same comp, although it wouldn't surprise me if the female was underpaid. And all of the ways that the organization see these people is going to be identical. This is where our current process is failing us. And this is why if you're doing a cycle that doesn't have ONA, you are doing a disservice to not only your employees, but to your bottom line.
Okay, so quick question. Is the feedback that people are providing, is it confidential?
So, okay. I mean, there are many ways to do this methodologically, but what we find is, you know, psychological safety is probably one of the most important things about these surveys if you want to be able to get authentic data. So the recipient of the feedback in terms of the, you know, the person who's being talked about, they are unable to see directly any criticism or negative feedback directly. Only their manager and above can see that. But from a positive perspective, in terms of like any positive comments or mentions, et cetera, they're able to see that information anonymously so that they can actually be recognized for their work. But there's not a this kind of like obligatory incentive, because, you know, if people know who I'm going to say this about and who I'm not going to say this about, I might feel pressure to be inauthentic. So the idea here right. is we find the enough anonymity so that people can be authentic.
Right. And so then my next question is, to some extent, doesn't it depend on the size of the team? Like if you're on a team with five people, right? So like, is it like teams that interact with your team as well? Like how do you kind of define the group of people that are involved in this process?
Yeah. Well, one thing I would say is it's always important to make an apples to apples comparison. So as much as you can, you know, you want to look at a peer group. These are typically people who share the same job description or share the same comp band together. So that would be maybe a functional split and a level split. So we can say these people are doing the same jobs. But what I would also add is what this methodology, what organizational network analysis also allows us to consider is all of the people outside of a person's team that they're impacting. And that's really important because we are so collaborative and cross-functional today in the way that we work. The number of touch points that any single employee can have has just exploded. I mean, in a network world where work is happening over Slack and Teams and Zoom, I mean, you can have dozens of interactions with your coworkers every day.
Right.
You know, when I was in college, like they taught me to manage by walking around, and like nobody has shown me how to do that over Zoom, right? There's just so many, but not only that, but we actually reward and value autonomy. Like the employee that I value the most as a manager is going to be the one who I can give a problem to and then say, hey, you know, call me if you get stuck, right? And then a week later they come back and they have the answer. But there were dozens of interactions that happened for that person in that period of time that I wasn't a part of. And ONA is a way of capturing those interactions and starting to make them quantifiable. That's the power of it.
So like what size of organization does this really start to work for? Like in my head, it seems like there's an employee headcount number where this becomes even a lot more beneficial. Like, of course, I see the application for early stage organizations, but I would see this more as like a late stage. You got a company, it's starting at like 500 employees, 1,000 plus, where it's like they have a team of engineers, 30, 100 people. Like I see the application really fitting there. I mean, am I kind of in the right ballpark or what are you seeing?
Yeah. So high level, the quick answer is Dunbar's number, which is this number. It's kind of like this theoretical number of like when organizations like stop knowing each other's names and like stop really like having that cohesive connection. You know, some say it's like 100, it could be higher, it could be lower. There is some hypotheses that Dunbar's number is lower in remote settings. It hasn't really been proven or disproven yet, but I hypothesize Dunbar's number is somewhere around 50 in remote settings and maybe around like 100 to 150 in non-remote settings. So, and that's the number where like the managers start getting less and less visibility, right? So anywhere from 100 to 200 people, depending on how your organization is distributed, you can start getting value from doing some kind of organizational network analysis, because the moment that your managers can't see everything that's going on directly, that's the moment when there's a benefit by getting this additional information from the network.
Okay. So would you say, do you start and scale positions, like scale individual contributor positions that you're hiring for and kind of like a lot of openings, or like, do you see what I'm saying? Is that where you start?
I'm trying to follow.
Okay. So like if you hire 50 SDRs or 20 SDRs, right? Mm-hmm. Like versus if you have a position, you only have like one product marketing director of product marketing, but you have like 20 engineers, right? Like the application, would it be more so for the larger group of people that are in the same position, or could you leverage it for positions that maybe they're not scale positions as in you're not hiring dozens of them at the same time?
It's so interesting because kind of implicit in your question is this idea of kind of like almost like doing it with like subsets or with groups of your organization. But the irony and part of the reason why this methodology is so useful today, right, in this network connected world is it really is best done with everybody, regardless of your team size, right? Because because we're so cross-collaborative. I mean, even if you have a team of 25 SDRs, you're super, you know, sales-driven as an organization, maybe some of those SDRs might be, you know, chit-chatting with some of the marketing folks. So they might be, there might be some very inquisitive folks that have a product bend that might actually be interacting with the product team. I mean, the way that people, or even I've seen the opposite, right? I mean, I was, you know, Doctor.com was a sales-driven organization. We had some fantastic salespeople that were actually like driving feedback and information from their meetings to the products team. And the products team found them to be incredibly valuable. In a world where you're just doing these like siloed manager reviews and people are just focused on like the five people that they talk with, like next to them, maybe in a physical office, you're going to miss these cross collaborative opportunities to see where people are actually providing tremendous value to the organization. So the short summary is, if you're going to do ONA, you kind of want to do it with everybody because you want everybody's perspective and you want to have these diamonds in the rough, things that you're not aware of, outstanding network contributions manifest and become aware to the managers that you wouldn't be aware of otherwise.
Right. And I think so. This makes sense to me. I have a few kind of like nuanced questions where, I mean, I get the value overall, but like some things that are coming top of mind to me is like knowing exactly who to pull in for each role. And that, I guess, has to be a bit of a manual process because you only want to pull in people to this like survey, if you will, about somebody's performance or asking, not performance. I know you ask like, who do you go to for help with that kind of stuff, but you don't want people that don't really know that person to weigh in on them necessarily. Right. Because.
Well, so it's interesting because again, implicit in your question, I think you're thinking about these like they're 360s, but they're completely different from 360s. And this is like the big mental shift, right? We come from a world where in performance reviews, you pick ahead of time who you're going to talk about, and then you share a bunch of information about that person, whether it's upward or lateral or downward, and then you're exhausted, and then you throw this information away for a year, and then you don't do anything with it. Organizational network analysis is completely different. It's like a 15-minute survey, and it's completely open-ended. So you ask these questions, you don't ask about like, what do you think about so-and-so? It's literally open-ended. And you go, who do you go to for help and advice?
Okay.
Who energizes you at work? You know, who are you concerned about? And so people can choose to mention nobody or they can mention 15, 20 people. I mean, and we see that actually. I mean, we see a, you know, a long tail of output in terms of who people go to, et cetera. So you're literally starting with that blank slate and then you're letting the network tell you who's valued by the network, who's being seen and recognized.
And they're obviously not going to bring somebody up if they don't interact with them.
And that's what's most telling is in a world where people feel unsafe to share, to snitch, if you will, on others, what you find is the best ways to get signals are to see no signal. You know, if in other words, in an organization where, and I say this as an introvert myself, actually, because, you know, some folks listening might go, oh, does this bias towards extroverts or does this, you know, this popularity contest? Turns out from our research, the answer is no. And in fact, our data identifies quiet contributors. So, you know, if you've heard of quiet quitters, right? Mm. They're these quiet contributors, these folks that tend to be introverts. They tend to contribute significant amounts of work. They tend not to know how to sell themselves upward. And those are the people that often get recognized in these surveys that they would not get recognized for in a traditional review process.
Yeah, I mean, where my brain initially went was like, well, is there going to be some kind of bias? Like if somebody speaks up on meetings a lot, then they're going to be top of mind for these surveys. And so like, and I think that still could be potentially a concern, right? Because like no system's perfect, but like then there's the layer deeper where you go into it and you're like, well, actually, this is a way to ensure that quiet contributors like do get recognition, right? Because based on how the questions are framed, like you can kind of get around that there. But I still see, you know, people that are loudest might be more top of mind, right?
Well, those are the people who the manager is already aware of, right? The people who are the ones who speak up in meetings and who are great self-advocates, right? Who know how to sort of make a name for themselves. Those people, they don't need any additional recognition. The manager knows who they are.
Right.
In fact, everybody probably knows who they are.
Sometimes too much, right?
That's right. We've all worked with people like that. But the people who get overlooked in that system are those quiet contributors. So you have these people who are not great self-advocates. They're not the loudest voice in the room. But when you actually look at all of the people that they're impacting on a day-to-day basis, you know, people who they're helping with their work, people who they're motivating, and they often do it in a way that tends to be kind of behind the scenes. We want to capture those people's contributions, right? They may be really critical players in the organization. And by the way, you know, when you start to connect this to talent acquisition, those people who are really key influencers and key contributors, we also want them to refer the best people they've ever worked with, right? That's how we bring in talent and grow the talent of the organization. So it's critical to identify those people, even when they're not the loudest voices in the room.
Oh yeah, those are the ones you want. I mean, like, because I don't know if you've ever been on Zoom meetings where it's like a relatively big team, and then it's like the same two people just talking the whole time. And of course, like, you appreciate people that are engaged or whatever to some extent, but you don't necessarily get to hear the perspectives like of people that don't have as domineering personalities, right? Like, you want to get everybody's perspective. Hopefully, I feel like this is a good way to do that. And quite honestly, like, every question I have or potential, like, you know, follow up question, like, I feel like you guys have provided very logical, reason based reasons to overcome those concerns thus far. So this has been really cool, because I'm like, well, what about this? What about that? And you guys have a good answer for everything.
I'll mention one, just because you haven't mentioned it explicitly, but it's one that I'm sure our listeners might wonder about, which is this question of, is this a popularity contest? If you're asking people to pick, you know, or mention these people, you know, around them. And what I'll say to that is, if you don't ask people to substantiate why they wrote what they wrote, there's risk of that. And that's actually one of the most important things that we do, is that we ask when people say, I go to so-and-so for help and advice, we ask them to say, about what? You know, you have to say, why did you go to them for help and advice? When you're recognizing somebody for outstanding work, why did you recognize them? If you're concerned about somebody, we actually raise the character limit if you have a concern, to say, why do you have that concern? So when people provide this substantiation, actually, this is where, you know, we've had CEOs who use our product that describe it as feeling like it's God mode for their organization, because they have a dashboard where they just like hover over each person and they see, you know, like 200 characters or less each, like these snippets that describe in full detail everybody around them, like the perspective of where they're sought for help and advice, where they energized, where they outstanding, and where there might be concern. And of course, again, everybody's biased, but now we have a way to measure it. You know, a lot of people talk about bias in this concept, like, oh, you shouldn't do this O&A thing because what about bias? And it's like, well, first of all, let's talk about the status quo today that is horribly biased with one person who's a manager, right, who, you know, tends to, I won't go into more detail there. You can imagine where I'm going to go with that, but And let's actually like consider looking at what people say, and then we actually can measure bias, and we can do a lot more with that data than the world we live in today.
All right. So I have like a 6-year-old analogy, like, which I always like, it helps me understand things a little bit better. But like, you know, when you go to like a fair or something and they have like, you're guessing how many gumballs are in the machine or how much somebody weighs. And then you take like the aggregate number that a bunch of people give and it's insanely accurate. Have you ever experienced that?
Although I haven't, it totally makes sense.
Yes, I absolutely. Yeah, the gumball analogy is really apt here. The ability for one person to hazard a good guess on how many gumballs are in that machine is pretty poor. And you could very much liken a manager's point of view to that. You know, the manager has an important job to do, but it also comes with bias. It comes with idiosyncrasies. Some managers are easy graders. Some managers are hard graders. You could think of this as a sort of crowdsourced guess, right? As to how many gumballs are in that machine. And I think what we see in our data is it's much more accurate than merely getting a single point of view.
Right, right. And I think, so I would like to also dial in on negative feedback. So, like, what question, I mean, you said, do you have any concerns? I mean, I think that this is a big part of it too, because sometimes, well, I think performance and people that are kind of problematic in terms of their interactions with people, a lot of times there is overlap. Sometimes performance might be all right, but it's like somebody's toxic, so they're not necessarily a direct, there isn't a direct relationship there. I think it just depends. So what are some of the questions you ask to identify concerns, right?
We literally only ask the one. It's, you know, who are you concerned about needs additional support or attention? And what's interesting is this is a question that nobody ever asks, right? And isn't this interesting? Like, you talk with your friends, you talk with the people that you know at any workplace, and everybody's constantly like, you know, sharing, you know, whatever, the tea, you know, in the office. But nobody in leadership is often aware of like all of the reality that's actually happening, because they never ask, because there's never been a vehicle to ask.
Yeah, I think that if you were to bring this into a manager rating scale, you know, we talk about having a 1 through 5 scale of manager ratings, but the reality is, you know, we speak with a lot of CHROs who basically say, yeah, I have a 3-point scale. I have most people meeting expectations. I have a smaller number of people exceeding them, and I have very, very few people who are outstanding. And then a lot of the lower ratings never get used, because often managers just want to, they want to avoid difficult conversations. You know, if I give somebody a needs improvement, now HR is going to get involved. And if that person leaves, then I've got to go through a hiring process again. And it's just work that they don't want to do. But what we find is, you know, if you have this problem of ratings bunching up at kind of the 3 or 4, ONA is actually a great way to sort of bust the myth of meeting expectations, because what you'll see is, wow, actually tons of people who 6 months ago were getting a meets expectations rating from their manager suddenly have a lot of critical feedback around them. It's very hard to sort of continue the status quo of sort of giving somebody that rubber stamp of meets expectations when the people around them have raised these concerns through a channel like organizational network analysis.
One of the biggest joys that we have, I don't know if it's joy, but it's like, I don't know, a reality moment, let's just say, like a come to your deity kind of moment, is when we do these reveal days where organizations, CHROs, CEOs who've been doing it the old way, we take their data from the past and all of the manager ratings that they had, and then we combine that with the data from this ONA process. And what they find is, honestly, it's a little mortifying, because they realize that in some cases they promoted somebody horribly toxic, oftentimes a lot of folks, candidly. And then they see these outstanding people that everybody went to for help, advice, energy. They were huge recognition. They were quiet contributors, you know, who left the company for comp reasons. Those two things happen so often that it's... not only is it boggling to the mind, but it's insane how much money people are losing by doing performance reviews the old way.
Yeah, for sure. So I have two questions. I have so many questions about this. This is so much fun. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I'm learning a lot. Okay. Is this enough to make a promotion or raise decision just based on the analysis that you're doing with this methodology? Or are there other factors that need to be considered in addition to this methodology?
Yeah, so the answer is the second. So when it comes to things like promotion, it's not a promotion is the intersection of someone's ability or readiness to be promoted, as well as the company's ability to promote, right? We have to have the pot of money there to be able to pay these promotions, et cetera, et cetera. But what I would say is that out of every promotion cycle, and I would even say whenever, for example, a PIP is happening, what characterizes those done well is that nobody is surprised, right? What you don't want to come out of a promotion cycle saying is, oh man, I can't believe they promoted Bob. He's such a jerk. Right? Or man, they put Mary on a PIP. I mean, she's fantastic, right? What you want to do is eliminate those surprises. That's what ONA will allow you to do. Mm-hmm. What essentially is happening is that you have the organization expressing its point of view on who it wants to elevate, and also occasionally who it wants kind of voted off the island. Now, as a manager, you know, you may still have the rubric. These are the five responsibilities of this job that have to be fulfilled, or the five responsibilities of this level. That's still important, but at least we can make these decisions with a complete picture of what this person is doing that's impactful, and sometimes what they're doing that's destroying value as well.
Right. Right. Okay. So that's also very helpful. My next question. This is just kind of like a side thought I had. I'm almost wondering, and I haven't given this any thought because I literally just thought of it 5 minutes ago hearing you guys talk. When it comes to hiring, right? I almost wonder, because if you think about a traditional interview process, right? Where it's, you have your screening round, then you have with the recruiter, then you have your call with the hiring manager, and then it's whatever, how many steps afterward. And it's like at any stage in the process, based on a interviewer's bias, somebody could get passed after one round, despite, let's say, three rounds, they get an excellent rating. And then one round, somebody's like, nope. And so I'm almost wondering if there's a place to think about people progressing to the next round of an interview based on an aggregate score.
Absolutely. You're touching on like a future that we get really excited about, which is a future where people are owners of their performance review data, even after they may leave or be interested in leaving a company. That's actually a world that we're excited to build towards. And, you know, if you think about, just to give a weird analogy, right? Like loans and credit, right? Like 100 years ago, before credit bureaus existed, like the way that you got a loan, you probably needed to be, you know, a married white heterosexual male, like who was charismatic. You'd have to go have an interview, you know, and convince them to give you a loan. The way that hiring works today looks a lot like how getting a loan looks like 100 years ago, which is kind of sad, right? Because all the same biases, all of the same problems that you just touched on, they are inherent in the hiring process. And the reason is it's an information asymmetry problem. The people hiring don't know about you. You don't know about the people that are hiring. But the irony is there are tons of people on both sides that know all of this information. And it's literally just a matter of getting that information surfaced and having it be trusted and accurate. And so, yes, we would love a world where people have the ability to export their performance information and share with somebody who's hiring that information, and you can actually get that context. And that could enable somebody to then have a much less biased perspective in the interview process. And that one, you know, awful, toxic, you know, really, really biased interviewer, their opinion will matter less once you have more data from more people.
Yeah, I think that that's incredible. I think I think that there's two ways to look at it. There's one where people own their performance data and bring it with them to the interview with another company. There's another way where I was referring to, it's like in the interview process with the other company, their ability to pass through the next round is based in aggregate based on scores, at least to like a final round, to where it's like there isn't bias of one interviewer and it's looked at in aggregate. So like you don't have a great person who's just passed on by somebody because they're having a bad day or because they're not like a trained hiring manager. So like to me, I see like two potential applications there. The former, what you're referring to is like bringing along performance data. One of the things that like my mind immediately goes to is like, that's incredibly valuable, first off, right? Like I could see that being a total game changer. And I love the analogy you provided related to credit and loans. And it's like, when you think about that, that's so freaking scary. It's ridiculous. So I'm with you. I think the hard part in terms of implementation would come down to liability. Some employers not wanting to release performance-based data with the concern that there could be some sort of like litigation, right? If somebody doesn't get a job based on what is some kind of information leaked from their performance previous company, there are a lot of companies who have the policy not to release performance information. So,
well, you know, the funny thing about that is that in a lot of big states, especially states that have a lot of tech workers, California, New York, every employee actually has the right, even after they've left the company, to request their employment file. And that includes performance reviews. Now, there are, I think, other reasons why those don't get shared. Like, you know, even if I have my performance review, I'm probably not going to go to an interview and share it with a prospective employer. You know, it's kind of silly, right? A prospective employer looking at my last performance review, and they're going to say, look, I don't know who your manager was. I don't know what it meant. I don't know what meeting expectations meant to them, right? So really, what's the point? But to build on Dave's analogy of what credit bureaus did is they didn't just make the information portable, they made it standardized. So if we were to say, for example, as an answer to that question, you know, who do you go to for help and advice? If I were able to say, yeah, you know what? I was in the 90th percentile of most helpful experts in my company, and I have the data to prove it. That's a powerful thing. That goes a lot farther than a manager saying, yeah, Josh met expectations. And the reality of the world that we live in today is that you can have a long and successful, impactful tenure at a company, but when you go out into the job market again, you are suddenly on a level playing field with everybody else. And it is on you now to prove to every prospective employer that you really are as amazing as you say you are. And that's where quiet contributors actually get the short end of the stick.
Yeah, for sure. And I think so. Basically, I think I was oversimplified and kind of confusing two concepts, right? Like there's the idea of a reference call and there's an employee file. And I think that's an important distinction that I didn't initially make with my concern or potential area where it would be difficult to implement this. But you're right. If somebody has a right to their employee file, performance data, however it's structured, is something that they're able to pull, right? Like that's something that they would own, right? So then there wouldn't be any potential liability issues, I would assume, if somebody leveraged, or there'd be at least a lot less. I guess there's always some risk in business. People could always do whatever they want to do. But like it's if you wanted to share that with a potential employer, I guess everybody would have access to that if they wanted it, right? I mean,
our personal feeling is that your performance should be owned by you.
Right.
It's kind of interesting you mentioned reference checks, right? Because, I mean, they're the best approximation that we have, and you have to kind of hope that the person's going to be willing to give that information, right? And if they're sometimes employed to the company, they have a policy, right? They say, oh, I can't because of legal reasons, blah, blah, blah. But even if you do get it, there's a lot of, like, in terms of recency, a lot of stuff can get really old. And, you know, I was just watching a documentary on memory. We all know how horrible memory is and how it degrades over time and how you can implant false memories and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, that's where reference checks, you know, they have mixed reviews in terms of their utility because of this, right? But the interesting thing is that if you have performance review information becoming the property of the employee, you kind of avoid all of these issues. You're being compliant by law. You're getting the information that was accurate and recorded in the moment by the people around you. And this is part of the reason why ONA is so, so, so important if we do this. Because if you don't have that ONA, the world is going to be run by awful managers who are, you know, you have a crappy manager, they're going to make it hard for you to get your next job. So, you know, if there's nothing that folks listening have learned, please learn that the way to take away the manager's, you know, siloed power, or at least reduce it, is to invite additional perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, it's like from a hiring perspective or just an organizational perspective too, it's just thinking about the impact of a great manager and the impact of a terrible manager, or even like somewhere in the middle, right? Like it's never, you know, usually there's a spectrum. But yeah, I mean, it's like another way to think about it too, is like you're protecting against some, like a manager that maybe isn't that great. And there's just such a huge impact on the organization. If you have like, cause the thing of the leverage, right? You have one person leading a group of, you know, potentially 4 to 10 people, then that's going to impact the performance and the ability for that entire, all of that headcount to deliver. And then also not only the entire cost associated with that, but what's the opportunity cost and how's that preventing the company from achieving its goals? So there's like this massive cost. And like, what I feel like too, is like when you're, you know, for your product, right? It's like, you're going to companies and, you know, I don't know how much your product costs or whatever, but like whatever it does cost, like the argument is like, look, this isn't, you know, a problem of adding X amount of AR, like, cost to your budget. We are solving literally on average a 7 to 8 figure problem for your organization. You know, this isn't an X problem or a cost. This is like literally a multi-million dollar problem that you have that we're solving for you, which like the leverage of it, like I would love selling this product because like, it's just like,
it's very logical. And by the way, we usually don't get into like product talking about specific. It's more like high level like theory, but like it's just really relevant because I actually don't know other products really in the market solving it or thinking about it this way. Maybe they are out there, I don't know, but this is really the first time that I've really like heard of this and have heard of a product like solving this problem. So I just think it's really cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you touched on something so important. 70 to 80% of all the money that we spend to run our companies, that's going to payroll and benefits. It, like right. Almost everything else is a rounding error compared to the cost of people. Almost any product right. buy, the biggest expense of that product is the people who made it.
Yeah.
And you would think, given that, you would think that we would have much better tools for measuring the impact and the contribution of those people. But up until now, I think our tools have been pretty crude.
I agree. I totally agree. No, it's like it's all very logic based, like the very sound reasoning, very analytical. And I think it's pretty solid. It's really hard for me to think of anything that comes close. So, and again, like at the beginning of a call, just like not really knowing a whole lot about it, you know, a lot of concerns that I would have had, like initially, like I totally understand now that those shouldn't be concerns. And in fact, on the contrary, like this solves a lot of the problems. And I think maybe some of that bias comes in from like everything that we've experienced, like in this, like related to this topic has just been so shitty historically that you almost assume that like any solution is going to be like only incrementally better, but also sort of shitty. So it's actually pretty cool to see how you're solving this.
Exactly. You know, this is actually one of the hardest things that we face is, I mean, there's a whole set of people out there who basically say performance reviews are terrible. Kill the performance review. The performance review should cease to exist. Now, the reality is performance management still has to happen somehow, right? And, you know, they talk about continuous feedback and stuff, which again, you want that as like a baseline, but having no solution, of course, you're going to say this thing doesn't work. But in a world where you have ONA, it turns out that actually maybe performance reviews aren't the problem. Maybe the problem is that we've been giving managers too much power and we've been soliciting too little information from the network of people that we work with. The thing that I get most excited about, you know, as more people become aware of ONA and the power of it in terms of representing accuracy more than a manager's viewpoint will, is that it enables organizations to rightly recognize their talent for the difference that they make at work. You know, whether that difference is positive or negative, they can rightly recognize it. And in a world where there's a lot of injustice and there's a lot of bias and there's a lot of, I mean, we're seeing, you know, some pretty crazy Supreme Court decisions that are going to lead to a very interesting future, to say the least, and probably the splitting of organizations into those that care about certain topics like diversity, equity, inclusion, and those that don't. In that new world, I can't think of anything more important than to solicit the feedback and opinions of the network of folks that you work with so that people can be rightly recognized for the difference that they make at work.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like with a fundamental understanding that recruiting, employee empowerment, it's not like a segment of your business. It's the core of your business. And I think a lot of people get it wrong when they think about the idea of a people first culture. A lot of executives, it's just about fancy perks and all this stuff that doesn't correlate or doesn't have a causal relationship to us achieving our North Star metrics, the compounding growth, whatever the board's looking at. But they don't like stop to think about for a second that like literally nothing great has ever been built in the history of humanity without recruiting and empowering an incredible team of people. Like that's how important this is. And I think like that's like the mind shift set of like, that's what it means to be people first. It's understanding that truth, that logic, and then building from there to ensure that you have the best people in your organization. So I'm with you 100% on that. Well, we're past time. We went over, so I think we got to jump. I don't know about you guys, but I got something to jump on. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining me today. It's been incredibly insightful. I'm really impressed with both of you. We've had over 100 episodes. You guys are incredibly bright. Welcome to come back on the show anytime. And as we start to scale and enter the new growth market, I will be becoming a customer. So I'm just very excited to work with you guys in the future.
Thank you, James, so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
For sure. All righty. And for everybody tuning in, thank you for joining us. And we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode and gained a lot of valuable insights to help guide your talent strategy. I also want to say thank you to my team at Secure Vision for making the show possible. Secure Vision is the number one embedded recruitment provider, and we are a three-time category leader on G2. Secure Vision partners with over 150 companies to provide on-demand recruiters who specialize in either tech, revenue, or G&A. For more information, you can visit securevision.io. For more content, you can follow me on LinkedIn at James Mackey or on Twitter at James Mackey DMV. We've dropped links in the description. If you want to be on our show or have any topics you'd like for us to cover, reach out at breakthroughhiring.io. We really appreciate your support with reviews on Apple Podcasts. And lastly, make sure to tune in every Tuesday and Thursday for a new episode. See you next time.